My name is Vern Reakey. I don't know that all of you have been subjected to a session with me yet, so I'll just introduce myself. I am a professor of law at the University of Washington School of Law, beginning my 30th year, I believe, in that position. Once upon a time, I was a real lawyer. And I was asked this morning by John whether or not I would lead a discussion about the proposed amendment to the federal constitution, which is commonly known as the Equal Rights Amendment. And I'm happy to do that. Karn asked me a few moments ago whether or not I am for or against the Equal Rights Amendment, and I said yes, but not enthusiastically.
Yes for or against?
Yes. But not very enthusiastic. I'd like to say three things as a preface to our discussion of the proposed amendment tonight, and take a few moments on each one of these three points, and then I really would welcome and encourage your points of view about it, and comments and questions and so forth. The three things that I want to say are these. First of all, I would like to say something about what the amendment is, because I rather suspect that there are many people in the United States today, maybe some even in this room tonight, who have never read the proposed amendment. Secondly, I would like to say something about why this proposal was ever made, who made it, what kind of people are supporting it, and where they're coming from. And thirdly, I would like to say something about what the probable practical consequences of adoption would be. And I would like to say that in the context of the experience that we have had in the state of Washington, where we have had almost the identical Equal Rights Amendment, which was adopted here in 1972, and we've now had 6 years of experience with it. And some other states have had that experience also, and I think I can share with you some of the practical effect of the Equal Rights Amendment. And for these comments, I will be putting on a different hat. Among other things that I do to amuse myself in my off hours, I am the executive secretary of the Washington State Judicial Council, which is a statutorily created body which has certain responsibilities, including the responsibility of making certain of our statutory laws conform to our constitutionary mandates. And in this job, the staff of lawyers that I have assisting me in this function had the task of conforming our statute law to the Equal Rights Amendment, and therefore I got to have a good look at what practical consequence it had. Now that I've told you what I want to talk about, I shall begin to talk about those three points. On the board behind me, I have put the magic words from the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution and to the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. I put them on the board in order to give us a very quick lesson in constitutional law as a way of understanding the text of the proposed Equal Rights Amendment, which I will read to you as soon as we have had our lesson in constitutional law. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution is usually thought of as being that amendment which says that a person doesn't have to give testimony against to incriminate himself, and it says that, but that's not the clause we are looking at. The magic clause that we are looking at tonight is the one that says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. no person shall be deprived. Deprived. An English word which means to have something taken away from you which you already have. To have it taken away. Of your life, of your liberty, or your property. You cannot have these taken away from you. The presupposition is that you already have the right to life, to liberty, and to the ownership of property. And you can't have that taken away from you unless you have received due process of law. And that means, at the very minimum, that you shall have had a chance to speak in your own defense, that you shall have had a chance to make your case, that you shall have been heard by some judge or by some jury in a regularly constituted judicial process. So you can't be put in jail, you cannot be subjected to a fine, you cannot have your property taken away from you unless and until it's been done in a way which we have approved as being a legal, proper, due process kind of proceeding. The point that I want you to understand is the Fifth Amendment starts with the presupposition that a person, one person, every person already has. In our Declaration of Independence, we say we believe that human beings are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are, you see, and these cannot be taken away from us. Now that comes very close to being an absolute right. Not a relative one, not a comparative one, but an absolute right. And so the Fifth Amendment, the only question that's asked once you decide that you've got a human being that has rights, he looks like a human being, and I suppose tastes and smells and acts like one, probably is a human being, and therefore has these rights. And the only question that's asked is, when he has lost something, has he had due process? If he hasn't had due process, it's all over. There is no way that you can justify taking away life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That's not relative. It's absolute. He's entitled to due process. 14th Amendment. The magic sentence out of the 14th Amendment is that no law of the federal government and no law of a state government may deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. Now, we're not talking about depriving somebody of something that they already have in the 14th Amendment. We're talking about public action which would deny to people equal protection with, now you've got to do a comparative thing, with somebody else. Well, with who else? Well, with other people who are in the same kind of a classification. You do not compare things which are not like each other. Yeah, that's very important. You got to understand this. Otherwise, I give you a failing grade to start with. In the Fifth Amendment, we're talking about one individual who possesses rights, and it's an absolute. You can't take away those rights without due process. Not relative, not comparative, not anything of that sort. But in the 14th Amendment, we are saying that this person has to be treated the same way that we would treat another person in that same classification of persons. Well, how do we classify? See, that's a comparative thing. You've got to treat them equally. That's the magic words. Shall not be denied equal protection. Well, equal with whom? Equal with people who are classified for that purpose in the same classification. Well, how do you decide who's classified which way? That's the magic of the 14th Amendment. The classification has to be one which is rational. It has to be one which is meaningful to the particular kind of protection that you're talking about. And it cannot be overly extreme. And that's a very relative, comparative thing. So, for example, certain kinds of categorizations or classifications are simply invidious and discriminatory in themselves. You may not classify people by, you may not classify people by race. Never is that a rational, meaningful, necessary kind of a classification. There is no reason to say that we ought to treat brown people differently than we treat yellow people. Now, there can be reasons why you should treat young people differently than you treat old people. That can be a rational difference in the classification. It would be irrational, I think, for almost all purposes to say that we're going to make one law applicable to everybody that has blonde hair and another law, and the same law not apply to people who had brown hair. At least I have difficulty thinking of why that would be a meaningful differentiation between the classes. Once we have decided what a rational classification is, then everybody in that class, everybody who's using airplanes, has to be treated the same. Everybody who's using trains has to be treated the same. Everybody who wants to go to a restaurant has to be treated the same for purposes of using the restaurant. It's inclusive in that classification. I hope that you now see that the 14th Amendment is a much less absolute kind of a constitutional requirement than is the Fifth Amendment. Because in order to crank up and make applicable the 14th Amendment, you first must go through the what is the classification that we are talking about. And there are a very few absolute prohibitions about classification. You may not classify by race. That is clear. You probably cannot classify by religion. Probably it's irrational in our governmental system to classify by religion. Usually you may not classify by age, but sometimes it's rational. Usually you may not classify by sex, although sometimes there is what is usually referred to as a BFOQ, a bona fide occupational qualification. Some jobs that you might be able to think of might be a bona fide requirement that it be a male, or a bona fide qualification that it be a female. But you would have to justify that differentiation by showing that it was a rational requirement to have only women or only men serving in that job. And usually you can't do that. Now, once more, the point is that the denied equal protection amendment, the 14th, is a much less absolute. It isn't absolute. It's a relative kind of a question of reasonableness, of rational degree, much less stringent than is the Fifth Amendment. All right, now listen, if you will, carefully to the proposed Equal Rights Amendment. Section 1. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Equality of rights. 14th Amendment. Shall not be denied equal protection of the law. So to start with, we are talking about a rational, reasonable, it applies only if it's sensible to apply it. It is not the kind of an absolute requirement that you would find in the Fifth Amendment. Now, I expect that you all understand that perfectly clearly without any problems at all. Because 30 years of teaching law has taught me that after I've said this 30 times or 40 times to a class, they still don't understand what I'm talking about. But of course, you're all bright enough to have gotten that just like this. Section 2. The Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation, the provisions of this article, no constitutional provision is automatically applicable except those that are absolute, like the Fifth Amendment. And so Congress is going to have to enact statutory implementation of the equal rights protection. Now that's true, you see, because the only thing that the constitutional amendment would protect against is laws which discriminate. We're not talking about taking something away that you already have. We are talking about the enactment of new laws which irrationally classify and thus invidiously discriminate, either state law or federal law. Section 3, the amendment shall take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. Now you all know, of course, that the date of ratification has almost come, and the time for ratification has been extended, and we wait a little bit longer now to see whether or not the necessary number of states, that being 3/4, will or will not vote to ratify and make the federal ERA amendment applicable. Why do we have such a proposal before us at all? What groups brought it through Congress for referral to the states for determination to ratify or not to ratify?
Excuse me,
Bert. Yes, ma'am.
Is that the whole amendment?
That is the entire amendment. It simply says equality of rights. Yeah, I'll read it again. The punchline. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied because of sex. That's it. Now, Karn is thinking what the rest of you already are thinking or will be thinking very quickly, and that is, well, that's not a bit different than the 14th Amendment. That's what the 14th Amendment says. So what's all the hooping and hollering about? I'll get to that in just a few moments. Karn is, of course, right. But we wouldn't want to say that until after we kicked it around a little bit. It's no secret that women have been treated differently and less advantageously in economics in the United States since 1776. It is true today that women are paid less for doing the same job as men do when they do it just as well. It is true today that women in most states do not receive some of the social benefits from government that men receive under like circumstances. It is true that the last survey showed almost a 40% discrepancy. Now that's true. Why is it true? Well, it's true because nobody has yet pursued the remedies which lie inherently in the amendments that already exist to the federal Constitution. Why haven't they? Well, partly because women have never felt the kind of need, perhaps, or perhaps they just have not, until recently, become aware of the fact that avenues for redress were available. Plus the fact that it's not the easiest thing in the world to make and to win a constitutionally based argument. Well, who are the groups that have brought this to our attention? How did it get through Congress? The proposed amendment is supported, as many of these amendments are, by a coalition. And the coalition involves groups that run all the way from the far right to the far left. You can find almost any kind of a sponsoring group in this coalition, this combined group of people. And their motivations range very, very widely. Some groups sponsoring this bill have in mind nothing further than equal pay for equal work. Some groups have in mind something as broad as absolute freedom without question with reference to abortion and the whole bit, you know, homosexuality, everything. And you get the entire range of supporting groups here. As is usually the case, those who get the most coverage in the media, and who make the loudest noises, and who are the most abrasive, are those which are, does the word radical fit the situation? Now, does it make any difference what the supporters of the proposed Equal Rights Amendment have in mind? Doesn't the proposed amendment mean what it says, no matter what people who are supporting it have as their objective? The answer to that is a firm, clear yes and no. You do not solve specific problems with the generality of a constitutional statement. Constitutional statements are broad, general, not specifically applicable enactments. Constitution is meant to be a broad-based foundation for specific legislation. Section 2, Congress shall implement the amendment if it is ratified. It will be that implementing legislation that makes the difference. Now, what kind of statutes could Congress enact? Well, Congress is motivated in part by lobbying pressures. I'm sure that's news to all of you. People who get to Congress and say, we want you to implement Section 1 with your implementing powers granted in Section 2 by certain kinds of statutes, well, voters still tell their elected representatives what kind of implementing statutes to enact. And Congress could enact very broad or very narrow implementing statutes. They may not, however, go beyond the permissible breadth of what the constitutional amendment will propose. That's the license of how far you can go. And if they go beyond that, then their enactment, as any other enactment of Congress, would be unconstitutional, not supported by the Constitution, and therefore invalid, ineffective, void, meaningless. What may Congress, what are the limits? The limits of this proposed ERA are almost identical with the limits of the 14th Amendment. In all probability, there is nothing that Congress could do after the enactment of the proposed ERA that Congress could not do today. I repeat, because if I'm in error, I want to record it as such. And it is my judgment that the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment would not enable Congress to enact any kind of legislation that it could not constitutionally enact today. The 14th Amendment, applicable to every act of the federal law and every act of every state. That's the end of point number two. Well, not quite. I want to say about point number two that don't be deceived by the banner headlines about the women who stand up and say, down with separate toilets for men and women. That is sheer, utter nonsense. And it has absolutely nothing to do with anything except people who can't get one idea from one side of their head to the other. What the law means is still what it says, and there's a lot of prior history in the United States constitutional law about what these words, equal protection of the law, means. There are literally hundreds of interpretive decisions, thousands of interpretive decisions, which, in my opinion, will be applicable to the enactment of the Equal Rights Amendment if and when it is ratified. All of this you can cross-examine me about in a couple moments when I am still and you get to talk. My third point, what would be the practical consequence of the enactment of a proposed amendment to the Constitution when those same powers arguably already exist, in my opinion, do exist in the amendments to our federal Constitution. I would like to divide this point into two subsections. Number one is what has been the experience in Washington. After all, we now have had 6 years under almost exactly the same language. Washington is a little bit rougher than the proposed federal Constitution. In Washington, we say equality of rights and obligations shall not be denied. The federal law says nothing about obligations. In Washington, we say women shall have the right to have the same obligations that men have. And so we have women paying alimony to husbands after dissolution of marriage and things like that. Big news. They did it before also. So no change. All right, Washington has had an equal rights amendment for 6 years, 1972 to date. We changed, I didn't bring these statistics with me because I didn't plan to talk about this, and therefore I estimate, and please don't hold me too closely to my estimates, but my best recollection is that we amended perhaps 200 of our statutes, maybe 250 or 300, somewhere in that range, of statutes that we had from prior years on our books. And that sounds like a lot of impact, until I tell you that in at least 95% of those cases, what we did was to take out the word his and put in person. But that's what his meant. Because in the old English that some of you grew up speaking as I did, when we wanted to include both sexes, we said his. You know, that's the way we used to use the English language. We don't anymore. Or at least it's changing. And so we, in about 95% of these 200 or 300 statutes that we amended, we changed the language. And it did not have any substantive impact at all. In fact, as I search my memory now, I cannot think of a single substantive change that was made in the law of the state of Washington by the adoption of the Equal Rights Amendment. I really cannot think of a single substantive change.
Any new legislation enacted?
None. Now, having said that, let me hasten to say that in one way this can be misleading, because Washington is one of 7 states that has what's known as a community property law. And in Washington, everything that my wife earns is community property. Half of all her earnings is mine. It has been that way since we were a state. Sometimes I have to fight to get it, but half of everything that I earn, should I ever earn anything, is hers. And it has been that way ever since Washington has been a state. Now, that is not true.
It's difficult for her to get it.
That's right. But that's, you see, the Community Property Act is not typical of most states in the United States. There are only 8 states that have a Community Property Act. So in most states, what she earns is hers, or hers and his, while what he earns is his. Community property, California, Idaho, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, have I named 8 yet? And a couple more that I may have forgotten. Mostly, the community property law came out of Spanish law and French law, so Louisiana, French law, Pacific Coast and Southwest out of Spanish law. So it's probable that in most of the strictly common law states, Pennsylvania, New York, and so forth, Minnesota, states like that, it probably would have a little bit more substantive impact than it has had in Washington. However, I repeat now my first premise, no more than could be compelled under the 14th Amendment anyway.
Well, then, what's the point of the exercise? If it's already all there, and if it's very little change, why all the flap? That's subdivision B in my third point. The flap is caused by some just plain hysteria. That's a nasty word to use. Misunderstandings, overstatements. There is no danger of unisex toilets. But more than that, more substantively than that, it is a very good way of alerting people to the fact that there does exist this kind of discrimination on the basis of sex. It's a PR, a public attention, it's an educational device. People, women, will know that they are entitled to. Employers will be alerted to the fact that they may not deny on the basis of sex without other bona fide occupational qualifications. You don't have to pay everybody the same. We haven't reached that stage by any means. But if you have two people, both of whom are equally good chemists, and they're doing the same job side by side, you're going to have to pay them the same wage. That's all that this really says, you see. And the significance of it is that the enactment of the Equal Rights Amendment flags that. It simply identifies it. Now, we have had in the state of Washington, I would guess offhand, maybe 12, 14 Supreme Court decisions which have dealt with our Equal Rights Amendment. People have claimed that they were suddenly given new substantive rights. Homosexual marriage, for example. The court says, don't be silly. We decided that under the Equal Rights 14th Amendment a long time ago, and that's the way our litigation has gone, and that's the way it's gone in other states too. So the significant impact, in my judgment, of the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment is largely psychological and educational. Neither one of those is a bad thing.
If it now fails, could one turn around and say, in the same forces that are pushing for its adoption, could they turn around and say that while it has failed for its vote, special amendment, we are advised on good legal authority, and they'd have to quote their authority, that we have a coverage of everything that we need and want in the 14th Amendment, so that the 14th Amendment would get be lifted up and get a new authority in the thinking of the people?
Almost surely so. And the fact that the ratification fails would not be a significant argument to try to decrease the significance of the 14th Amendment, because failures to enact are not taken as expression of the will of the people, except with reference to the item which was not enacted. But the Pandora's box has been opened, if I can use that that expression, on the question of equality of treatment for all kinds of different groups, and the prevention of irrational classifications. If I've managed to get that idea kicked out clearly, that's underway. Yes, sir. Ma'am?
Would you argue with the lawyer now for the ERA amendment? Why? I mean, obviously, there are a lot of people that think that the 14th Amendment is just not doing it. Are you all you have to say on it? Is that it just is a PR thing? Or?
The 14th Amendment will never do anything. It just sits there in the book and stares at you dolefully. It's going to take Mary Schramm, who one day gets really exercised and decides to claim that her employer, Holden Village, has discriminated invidiously and thereby violated. In other words, you've got to get people to the point where they will use the existing arguments. And question, will people be more likely to use the Equal Rights Amendment than they are likely to use the 14th Amendment? Yes, I think so. I think that people will assume that the enactment of the ERA, if it is ratified, has increased their rights. And in that sense, you see, if people assume that it has, maybe as a practical consequence, it will bring about a broader implementation, and therefore the practical effects will be more equal treatment than there would have been otherwise. I do think that theoretically the 14th Amendment would give you the same results, but then theory doesn't always spell out in actual application in this way. You get people aroused to the opportunities and they're more likely to use them. One other comment that I should make. You understand that all of these things, the ERA, the 5th, the 14th, and all the rest of the amendments, apply only to public acts. No act of the Congress, no act of the legislature shall invidiously discriminate. It doesn't apply to what I do as a private individual. It's no public enactment, no law. You see, you may not be denied equal protection of the laws. That's what we're talking about. Now, of course, if I am using a law, if I'm acting under a law to take away somebody's property or something of that sort, then there has to be equality of application of the law. But we're talking about public acts in constitutional amendments.
And what requires an employer to pay equally?
Because the employer, in most of these cases that you've seen, is an employer who either is acting with federal money or is acting in a under the authority of some public
there's
enactment.
There's a promise or something. What if
yes.
It's not? What if it's just a private?
Then we ask the question of somebody can probably still find something that's not in federal commerce. It's not very much of that left anymore. If feeding chickens in your backyard is an interstate act, and it is, because either the grain or the chicken, you know, the chicken may get across state borders someplace or something. But if we could find something which is state, then we would have to go to the state law.
But usually that's not the case.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, very seldom the case.
Can you give us an example of what would not be considered public?
What would not be a public act? If I didn't want to play bridge with women, I wouldn't have to. Unless it were a commercial bridge game.
If you were a private club.
There are some kinds of private organizations. Faith Lutheran Church. The Elks. Not in commerce.
And even though the ALC has authorized the ordination of women, doesn't compel congregations to call them. Mm-hmm.
That's right. There are those areas of private acts, yeah, of privacy, you see, which are not covered, but they're not authorized by and they are not implemented according to legislation.
I've heard so many comments about women in the draft. Would you care to speak to that? What any effect that you would see?
We now must, the question is whether or not if we enacted ERA, we would have to draft women as well as men if we had a draft law again. Would Congress be compelled to extend the draft law so that women would be called to military service screaming in protest as some of us were? Congress shall implement Section 2 by constitutional legislation. If Congress enacted a draft statute, would it be a rational, reasonable classification to say men yes, women no? Answer to that question. Are there bona fide occupational qualifications? Is the requirement of the job different? I'd like to give you a yes or no answer and thereby confuse the whole issue. But you see, the question you've asked me and the answer I give you is, are there really bona fide occupational qualifications which differ for which military service
would require differentially for men and women? Is there a rational basis to say this ought to be done by men and not by women? Now, I think personally, I'm being a veteran and having won the war and all of those things, I think that there are some jobs where it would be quite irrational to say that women ought not to be drafted just as men would be. On the other hand, I think that there are some jobs there would be bona fide occupational qualification differences. I think that argument could be made. I may be wrong in that. Number one, we would have the wisdom of Congress to explore and investigate that and enact a statute. And if we didn't like the statute that they enacted, either because we thought it was under or over inclusive, then we would test it in the way that we normally test legislation, by questioning its constitutionality under the new act. That I could do under the 14th Amendment, incidentally, but then that's beside the point. Karen?
The amendment does not say anything about rational enactment of legislation.
You just didn't see it or hear it, Karen. It's there in, I would guess, maybe 10,000 pages of it, all incorporated, because the words are the same as the identical words as in the 14th Amendment, and there's all of this interpretive gloss that's been piled on the 14th Amendment. Same words, same meaning. I mean, used the same way, you see. Equality of protection under the laws. And therefore, because we are forced to classify before we can compare equality treatment. Nobody expects to say that you've got to treat a 2-day-old baby the same way you treat an adult. So we've got to go through the classification exercise first before we can even ask the equality question. That's the interpretive gloss. And there's no way of avoiding it. Good, you're very perceptive, ladies and gentlemen. I congratulate you. Mm-hmm. Now, just remember, the Fifth Amendment is very different. That's the absolute one. You've got rights, and we can't take them away. This one is the comparative, relative, wiggly one.
What about the policy-making decision of lending institutions? A woman and a man in the same financial situation, usually a man can establish a higher credit rating than a woman can.
I think that's one of the really invidious discriminatory practices that we have in the United States today. We ought to ask the same question. What are the chances that they'll repay the loan? What kind of security do they have? Whether or not they are male or female is not really significant to that question. What is more significant is their educational training, their job, their security,
their history.
Are there any of the states who have refused to ratify the ERA amendment who have refused on the basis that it is already covered in the 14th?
Not that I'm aware of.
Are they refusing on the hysterical basis?
They're refusing on the basis. The most significant argument that I heard in the state of Washington was, if you let women have an equal voice with men, kiss your family goodbye. But that argument was made, I think, more tellingly with our legislators than any other single argument. You've got to have the strong guiding wisdom of the husband, or the family is ruined. I sympathize with that argument. But I'm being a little bit facetious, and I apologize for that. The argument was made seriously, that there is something about a family that requires a head, that you cannot have two people directing the same show. And that argument, as I say, was made very seriously and as a matter of moral principle with some people. And I think that's what's doing it in many states today, that there is a concept that there is sort of a God-givenness about the fact that the husband is the head of the house, and the wife better be subject to him. And I think a lot of the opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment is coming straight out of some teachings of the churches. That's sort of, I think, more rational than the we don't want unisex toilets arguments. That one I'm not very much impressed by. These other people, at least, I think, are making arguments in good conscience. Ma'am?
Going back to the draft, why aren't women drafted under the 14th Amendment? Is that
No one has ever made that argument that I know of, and we, of course, don't have a draft. Haven't had since this kind of discussion became common. Put yourself, well, I guess you can't do that, Mary. Yes, you can. You were old enough in the Second World War so that you learned to sing Frère Jacques under my sterling direction. Those of you who were a little older than Mary was in the Second World War, think back. You know, there was no discussion of this kind about drafting women in the Second World War that I can recall. Now there would be, obviously. If we were to have a draft proposal in Congress today, whether ERA was there or not, I am just certain that there would be strong voices raised for extending the draft to women as well as men. I'm just sure that would be the case.
With respect to passing the amendment itself or not passing it, there's been some discussion about those states that have passed it and in turn want to rescind it. And personally, I don't quite understand the legal basis for not being able to rescind what you have just passed.
Well, you've got a lot of company. Neither does anyone else. But there is no precedent in that area, and I think that's still an open question as to whether or not a state can, in fact, rescind. Maybe they can. Congress has said no, but then who pays attention to Congress? That's not a congressional question. That's a legal question. So that's an open point yet. Maybe we'll argue about that later. And I, of course, who knows really what the motivations are of the people who vote on these things? I think they range very broadly. One citizen thinks he's voting on one thing and somebody else thinks they're voting on something quite separate. And a lot of that confusion, I think, stems from the fact that probably 90%, 99%, you tell me, of the people who are talking about the ERA have never read it. I just bet you they have the faintest idea what they're talking about. Ma'am?
Have there been any cases suggested litigated or involved based on the 14th Amendment?
Oh, yes. Many, many of them.
And successfully?
Many, yes. Federal law, yes, indeed. The telephone company, insurance companies, a number of banks, lending institutions have all taken the deep six from militant women who have said, we think you ought to pay us as much for doing this job as you do the man at the desk next to us. There have been very substantial judgments issued because of discrimination on the basis of the 14th.
And age also, right?
Age, same. So that I sound like a broken record, don't I? I don't mean to say that the ratification of the ERA is not significant. Psychologically and in terms of public education, I think it's got a lot of practical significance. I think people the word aroused has connotations that I don't want. Will be alerted to, stimulated. Maybe it is aroused.
Or aware.
Aware, yes, that's right, you see. I think it's got that practical importance. It's an educational thing for all of us. But in terms of the actual underlying legal theory, I don't really think it would change much.
Is that a justifiable reason for an amendment to the Constitution? I don't know how much money
probably
been spent on all this stuff, but it seems like nothing
is true
about
that. Well, that's a question of judgment, isn't it, Karin, for all of us to think through for ourselves.
I think this point you're making has never been
lots of discussion.
It, and it just gets squelched by the press, and it's boring?
Doesn't make very good headlines.
Yeah.
Yeah, not nearly as good as single-sex toilets. You know, you can get a headline about any day of the week. But there's lots of discussion of this. The fellow in the office and I talk about it all the time. But it did. It obviously doesn't get talked about much on the streets. Part of the reason for that is that to understand the difference between the 5th and the 14th is kind of a necessary first step. And that's an awful boring subject. It's just not very exciting, I'm afraid.
Being a Christian community, how should we look at it in reference to the Bible?
Yeah.
I believe that a Christian person would not invidiously discriminate in any event. I don't think that anyone in love could say that because you are black or young or old or a woman or a man, I will not treat you justly and fairly and generously. If one is, in fact, struggling to live within the concept of the gospel, this is not necessary, just as all other law is not necessary.
But get down to specifics. I mean, the Bible tells us that a man should be the head of the household. The woman's work is a certain amount.
Where does it
the
say
Lord,
that?
The Lord?
Where does it say that?
I don't know. I don't know. I think we all here ought to pause, perhaps, and listen to our theologians on this matter, which I'm sorry, I'm not. I can tell you what I think about that. I believe that Jesus Christ is my Lord. And I know that the word Lord stems from a word called Dominus. And I know that dominus is related to something called dominion, and that God gave us dominion. And that Jesus Christ, as my Lord, as the one who is in dominion, taught me what lordship means in Christianity, and that is to be the servant. It does not mean the exploiter. It does not mean the one who, in the heathen context, lords it over his slaves. But Christ exercised his dominion in care and in servanthood, even to the point of sacrificing himself for his people. If I pattern my life as the head of a family in the concept of Jesus Christ, my Lord, I am my wife's servant.
He's also
that's what it means to me, and as I say, here we might stop and ask our theologians whether or not this is a fair interpretation. If I am to love my wife as Christ loved the church, I think I've got my answer. Jesus Christ is my Lord. He exercises the dominion of servanthood, and certainly the Equal Rights Amendment doesn't come anywhere even close to that. I can treat my wife a lot rougher under the Equal Rights Amendment than I possibly could as a Christian. That's my answer to that.
It's good theology.
Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. I like you too. I'll pay you right after the.
What that kind of boils down to, though, becomes a sort of a personal interpretation, doesn't it? And of course, then you get into all kinds of degrees of.
Yeah.
Even in theology, I mean, for example,
sure.
Among the churches, as you well know, some churches feel, not mine necessarily, but that Jesus Christ was a man and therefore certain things should follow in their church organization. Other churches don't feel the same.
It does.
So you would get into this general, it all comes down to your own interpretation of what you hear and read.
Yes, thank you for that, because you see, that is really the message that I would leave with you about the legal point of the proposed Equal Rights Amendment. Those words, equality of the law, are almost as broad as the Pacific Ocean. And what does that mean? Shall not be denied equality of the law, equal protection under the law. Well, the best I can do with that is that I've got lots of interpretation already on the 14th Amendment. It's a question of interpretation. Congress gets the first crack at it at the implementing legislation. Then if we don't like it, why, let's sue the rascals and find out whether or not they've acted unconstitutionally. And that's a lot of flex in there. The 14th Amendment and the proposed ERA has a lot of flex in it. Don't ever accuse anybody of being very precise in this kind of legislation. It's very, very broad, much broader than the 5th Amendment. 15th Amendment is pretty tight by comparison. No denial without due process. I almost know what that means. The United States Supreme Court told me once what it means in one of their decisions to deny due process of law. It said, a person is denied due process of law when he has not received the process which is his due.
I keep reminding myself about the parable, or maybe it wasn't even a parable, that Jesus Christ told about the fellow that he hired to work in the vineyard. He hired many different fellows, but he still paid everybody the same.
Right.
And he certainly wasn't equal to everyone, was he?
No, sir.
And so I don't feel that we should have to be equal to everyone either.
Don't think we do.
If I feel that I want to pay someone $50 for a job and someone else $25 for a job, I'm perfectly free to do so.
And I think you may.
Right?
I think you may. You see, the law in that instance is you must pay the man what he earned. 1 hour's wage, 1 half-day's wage, 1 day's wage. That's what the law requires us to do. Equal treatment for equal work. That's the Equal Rights Amendment. What the employer did in that case was to say, I will pay you more than the law requires me to do. I will, out of Christian generosity, make a gift to you. I only owe you $5, I'll give you 25. I wish I could claim that I treat my wife that way. I don't. Mm-hmm. She manages to treat me that way quite frequently, and I appreciate it.
That could be very well the same way in which a fellow hires two different people.
Very well be. There's nothing in any of this constitutional matter or legislation that says that you have to pay a person the same wage if they are not doing the same job. That's a matter of labor organizations and management and teams. Not a matter of constitutional legislation. Excuse me.
Might not perhaps part of the answer to your question be that then that there needs to be a change in the wage system, that women's wages are brought up to a standard that would be on par with what they ought to be earning for doing that job, and then if you feel like paying a man more, go ahead, but claim it as a charitable deduction or something other than wages on a paycheck. Because it's not equal pay. You're paying one person more and you're saying it's pay. It's not. It's a gift. And claim it as a gift instead of pay.
As long as you're never getting in a position where they can claim it. Yeah. What we are all three saying is if this could be done in such a way that the short-time worker could not literally claim it as being a legal right, then it's a gift. Then it's okay. If, on the other hand, it's done in such a way, like, come on, Joe, come down here and work. Now, you understand that I've got to pay you and Sally the same thing, but I will give you an additional $10. Now, if that is put in the context of a promise which becomes enforceable, then it's unequal promises and unlawful. If, on the other hand, a man wants to make a Christmas gift to somebody and it is not compensation, all right, that's...
Is there not another consideration that could... be brought in, having worked and supervised both men and women on like jobs, it's been my experience that even in cases where a woman might be more efficient, such as in certain cleaning jobs, well, it's true, some women are more efficient in some type of cleaning jobs than men are. But on the other hand, working with those women, you'll have more trouble than you will with the men, because they are greater complainers. I don't say this from anything other than my own personal experience in working with them. I have found that men will coast along and will put up with things, inconveniences, and not complain. But women are quick to complain, especially if they think that they've got a half an inch more area to clean than another woman has.
Let me try to answer that as carefully as I can. there are always two ingredients in a determination. Number one is, what's the rule that I'm going to use? The rule here is equal treatment for equal conduct. The other question is not a rule question. We know what the rule is now. Equal treatment for equal conduct. The other question is a fact question. If, in fact, one person is much more difficult to manage than another person, then they are not equal, and they need not be treated equally. However, you've got to establish that fact, and I'm sure you're well aware of the difficulty sometimes of establishing what one thinks one sees. That's a factual problem. And you might run into a sawmill if you went in saying women are gripers and men are not, or something else of that sort. It's a factual problem. If you can make the factual case, you can make the discrimination. if you cannot make the factual case, the law says they are equal and you've got to treat them equal. So what you're really dealing with is a factual problem. If one person is a more efficient worker, you ought to get paid more than another person. There's nothing wrong with that. They aren't in the same class, you see. That's the classification issue here that comes first of all. Is it irrational to require an employer to pay more to a person who does more work and less to a person who does less work? That's not irrational, is it? That's rational. Therefore, a classification which says good work, bad work, is not an irrational classification to separate those two. And once they are separated, because they are separated and not in the same group, they don't get equal treatment. That's the 14th Amendment. That's the Equal Rights Amendment.
Is tenure for teachers then...
It's the curse of the human system.
Yeah,
I know.
It goes against the 14th Amendment, then,
no.
Right? Because there are teachers, for instance, that could be proved that they are not producing the better work as somebody...
No, it's
somebody.
A contractually based right. That is to say, I hereby enter to a... I'm the school board. I enter into a contract with Vern Rieke that if he manages to live for 6 years, we're going to promise not to discharge him for certain, except for certain causes. I've really been retired for 24 years. I got tenure at the end of the first six. It's not irrational. It's no, not as long as all bums like myself can get tenure after 6 years. If it was only some who got tenure and others not, without bona fide reason, then it would be invidious discrimination. But as long as we treat everybody the same in a like class, then although it may be foolish and fattening, it's not unlawful.
I take it that same thing would apply to the general idea of, say, unionization, for example.
The same as?
The type of thing there, whether it's legal or not, I mean, a union setup, for example, would be
A union
situation.
Yes.
When you're undone, you pay a lot of people the same and they aren't the same.
Yes, that's because we have entered into a collective bargaining agreement that says that everybody who can walk out to the job is entitled to be paid. I'm grossly overstating these things. Please forgive me, I get carried away but that's the basic answer. Yes, sir. It's a contractually based right which does not discriminate in a class which has been identified. Now, therefore not invidious and therefore not unlawful.
Could I come back just momentarily to this thing on the relationship of husband and wife?
Certainly.
I'm just reading from Ephesians, the 5th chapter. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord.
Yes.
For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church.
Precisely.
And he is the Savior of the body. It goes on to say later on that the husband should cherish the wife, and this has to do with the way he would treat her.
Precisely.
But what has this really to do with a woman's worth on the job and the wages that she should receive, regardless of what her relationship in the home is? Take that literally, if you wish.
Probably nothing. I think really it has no application in a precise sense.
The brother didn't read far enough in Ephesians. He should have read that husbands were to love their wives even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it.
Amen.
I think the Lord required more of the husbands toward their wives than the wives toward their husbands, if you're asking me.
That's invidious discrimination.
That might be contrary to the scripture.
It's probably unconstitutional.
What about the hearsay or whatever that women therefore have to be paid by their husbands and therefore will have to pay Social Security? What really are the connotations in this talk? Is this something to first look forward to, and is it a good thing or a bad thing?
I see no possible way under this proposed amendment whereby a wife would be compensated that so many dollars per day for work. However, notice that in 8 states, including this one, in effect we've done that. The theory has always been in Washington and other community property states that the spouse who stays home is making as much of a contribution to the family as the spouse who goes out, because both are working for the common good of the family. And therefore, every dollar that Jane earns belongs to what we call the community in Washington. And the community consists of Jane and myself. We hold it in a tenancy called community property. It is ours, not hers, not mine, but ours. And when I said before that she owns half and I own half, that's not quite true. That would be what's known as a tenancy in common, and that's not what it is. It's a, we both own all of it. We both own all of it, of all of the earnings. And it's almost, you know, as wild as scripture in the sense that organizationally, Jane and I are one. We don't fight about these things. She tries to all the time, but I walk away from her. We are one. It's a family. And that's what this is aimed at. Rather than saying, well, this week, Jane, you didn't cook very well, which would be true. Therefore, I'm going to dock your wages as if I were the employer.
Right. Is there any possibility that having a separate amendment can lead to new legal precedents which would interpret the language in the
yes, sir,
right
there
amendment
is.
As
yes, sir.
Court to,
yes, sir, there is.
A substantive difference in the future.
There is always the potential that a new argument can be made that will lead the Supreme Court to interpret the same words differently. Again, I can only answer this with a couple more sentences, and if I'm boring you with this, I apologize, but I'm going to do it anyway. Think of the separate but equal provision for education in the United States. 50 years ago, thereabouts, it was perfectly clear that meant if you had two schools, one for white and one for black and one for red and one for yellow, as long as they were equal, which they never were, but theoretically, as long as they were equal, the fact that they were separate, perfectly constitutional. After Evenson against the Board of Education, United States Supreme Court, those identical words meant that you couldn't separate them, even if they were equal. Now, what had changed? Not the words in the Constitution. The words were exactly the same. What had changed? What had changed was the social environment. Now it is your time to think to yourself, jeepers, do you mean that the Constitution really means different things at different times? I hate to shake your confidence in our governmental system, but the answer to that is yes. The Constitution is read anew every morning because it is a living document which is intended to address the problems of the people who are living at that time, not our great-grandfathers. My great-grandfather had a set of problems which I don't have. I've got a set of problems that he didn't have. The Constitution says Congress, legislators, city councilmen, other people, enact statutes which are implemented in such a way as to be sure that people are treated equally. If that means they go to school in different houses, fine. If that means they go to school in the same house, fine. The test is, are you treating people equally? And that may vary from year to year. And so the Constitution, a constitutional decision by the United States Supreme Court is not binding precedent. The United States Supreme Court can say yes today and no tomorrow, and probably will. That's within the framework of what our founding fathers intended. The Constitution is a living, adaptable document. It's not like a statute which says the speed limit is 55. That means 55. It's much more inflexible than the Constitution. The Constitution is the theory, the spirit under which we live, not the detailed. And so the answer to your question is, you betcha. that maybe the enactment of the ERA would signal and make visible the fact that our thinking as a nation has changed about what equality means, and therefore it could lead to a different decision. Sure, but I think that's simply another piece of evidence to do what I think would be done on the 14th, but it's helpful, you see, as an argument. Ma'am?
I'm embarrassed to ask this, but I cannot remember. After the Civil Rights Movement, was the 14th Amendment just made stronger in everybody's minds, or did we have another amendment dealing with race?
We have had no substantial amendments in the matter of civil rights since the Civil War.
Substantial legislation.
Most of the actions that we've been talking tonight are not constitutional actions at all, but they're Title VII. Title VII federal legislation, you see. And it has, Congress long ago said you couldn't discriminate in employment on the basis of sex. That is the typical action today which has enabled women to gain equal pay for equal rights. It's nothing to do with constitutional argument at all. It's Title VII. Congress, you see, has had that power, constitutional power, to enact that kind of legislation long since. In the last decade, they've been doing it. Now, the only question that we're really asking ourselves is whether or not the ratification of the ERA will sort of egg the guys on to greater and faster efforts. And there are a lot of people who think yes. And I guess I'm one of them. I guess if I were a congressman and I wanted to know who would vote for me and who wouldn't, with, of course, no scruples or thoughts of my own about anything except whether or not I was going to get reelected, the ratification of the ERA would kind of be a signal to me that there were more people who liked that than who liked pink. So I guess that I would be influenced in my legislation.
Might not the failure of this proposal, this amendment to pass, be more significant in its effect than the passing of it? Whereas if it passed, we can do the same things probably that we can do already, but if it did not pass, mightn't that be very significant in the mood of the country and perhaps plunging a group of people, namely women, into a mood
it might.
And ignorance of what
I think there would be some women who would say, boy, that really puts the frosting on the cake, you know, and now I'm really going to go to work and I'm going to find some other way of confrontation or litigation or something to get what the nation is trying to deprive me or deny me. It might be that it would result in that sort of thing. We're guessing, aren't we, about social moods and those kinds of cultural patterns. It's a little difficult for my crystal ball. It's kind of cloudy on that one, but I think the answer is yes, it might.
You talked about the flexibility of the Constitution in dealing with different matters in different ways at different times.
Yes.
In your own opinion, do you believe the flexibility of the Constitution or the scope of it, whatever you want to call it, includes the right to force integration of races?
Yes. Yes, I do. I think that's well within the scope. The best illustration I can give you of that sort of thing is the fact that there are only two constitutional governments, really, in the United States, in the world, in the sense that we talk about it. One of them is the United States, the other one is England. In England, they have never written the first word of their constitution. England has no written constitution at all. It's a concept. And yet English courts hold English parliamentary enactments unconstitutional in exactly the same way that the American Supreme Court holds enactments of our legislative bodies unconstitutional. Well, if there's no writing, what is their constitution? It's the sense of decency. That's all the Constitution really is. When somebody does something to somebody that once makes you want to throw up, that's unconstitutional. That's the best test I can give you.
Well, what about the other side of the question? I mean, if you're going to bring out the thing about people being treated badly. What about white children being treated badly when they're bused for 2 hours to get to a black school? That's not very good treatment either. That makes me throw up.
Yeah. And at some point, you see, if it gets bad enough, then that's unconstitutional too.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's what they're doing.
And now we have a very difficult balancing act that goes on here. It, one is always met by the question of which one and how much. Law is always posed in the terms of opposing interests. If they're not opposing interests, there's no legal question. As long as Christian brothers agree together, there cannot be a legal problem. It's when reasonable people with reasonable arguments demand opposites in irreconcilable things, then we have a legal question. If you think about that for just a moment, ladies and gentlemen, of the hundreds of thousands of disagreements that come up in any given day, very, very few of those will go beyond the parties that are involved. They'll reconcile their differences. They're reasonable people. Now and then, one is so irreconcilable that they'll go talk to a lawyer about it. I'm very thankful for that. Of those that are taken to a lawyer, you know, maybe 1 out of 100, 1 out of 1,000, at least 99 out of 100 are settled there immediately. Although 1 in 1,000 of that 1 in 10,000 disagreements that get into a lawyer's office that are not settled immediately, an action may be filed. Statistically, almost 95% of actions that are filed are settled out without trial. You're getting down to an awful small number of disputes that ever get into the courtroom. Why do they get into the courtroom? Because reasonable people, reasonably informed, having talked to reasonable lawyers who are reasonably in conflict on reasonable precedents, are disagreed, and so they finally take it to a judge. That's the kind of stuff that the courtroom action is made up of. And to say that there is a yes or no answer to that is lunacy. You know, anything that's that close doesn't have a clear answer, for goodness sakes. If it did, it would have been settled long, long ago by the parties. Nobody's going to come into my office and pay me a substantial fee to have me get an answer from a judge which was obvious. Okay, so then what does the law decide? You know, the law, the answer that the judge cannot give is, well, maybe. A judge has two things he has to do. Number one, he has to say yes or no, and then he has to say why. And so most judges will say, well, this is an obvious case. Clearly, only this answer could be right. Answer is yes. It's like refereeing a football game, you know, when you didn't even see the play, but you got to call it. Well, you understand what I'm talking about. It's such a hairline decision in these things that we have to resolve this way that we're not really saying that either answer is right or wrong. What we're saying is that we have a process or a system which enables us to make a determination and then get on with our business. You know, get the game going. Do you ever read the rule book in baseball about what's a strike and what's a ball? A lot of people think that a pitched ball which goes inside of shoulder, kneecap, edges of the base is a strike. Not true. The rule says that a pitched ball which in the opinion of the umpire goes within shoulder, kneecap. The umpire cannot be wrong. He cannot be wrong. I don't care if that ball went 25 feet and hit the ground and bounced out and hit the infielder. If the umpire honestly says that he thought it went in that space, it was a strike. That's the rule. That's the way it is in law. Although we are frequently in error, we are never in doubt. Well,
it is now 7 minutes after 10.
I'm sorry.
That's a fact.
Go home and go to sleep. Thank you for hearing me out.